Hello, hello. It's Brooke Devard, and you're listening to the Naked Beauty Podcast. It is that time of year, end of December. New Year's Eve is around the corner. Everyone's thinking about New Year's resolutions, how they're going to be their best self, how they're going to lose this weight, how they're going to have the best skin of their life. I think all of that is great and wonderful and good, but self-improvement is a year-long process. It's something that we should think about all the time. It's something that I talked to my guest, Sarah Unger, about. Sarah's a colleague of mine, and she's incredibly thoughtful, and she knows a lot about wellness, so I was really excited to have her as a guest. And one of the lessons that I kind of learned from Sarah in my discussion with her was around gentleness and how important it is to just be gentle to yourself and take the time to invest in yourself and treat yourself well. This is a long episode, as they all are, so I encourage you all to just take some time and relax, spread some warm honey on your face. That's a great face mask, by the way. If you just warm up honey for like 30 seconds, raw honey, and put on your face and rinse it off, your skin's amazing. Do that. Take a bath. Make your own sugar scrub. Do whatever you need to do to relax and feel beautiful, especially coming out of this really busy holiday season. I don't know about you guys, but I've had back-to-back holiday parties and lots of cookies and champagne, and it's all good for the soul, but bad for the skin. So take some time to recharge and think about bringing a really good energy with you into the new year. Don't be hard on yourself. Don't give yourself unattainable goals. Kind of keep this idea of gentleness in mind. I have Sarah Unger here with me.
We're
going to talk about beauty and self-care and wellness. And actually, the first thing I wanted to talk to you about was that distinction between beauty and self-care. It seems superficial, or I hate telling people basically that I have a beauty podcast because I think people think that I'm talking about mascara and blush and what face mask I tried. I talk about that too, but I love the article that you sent to me about self-care being this kind of revolutionary feminist act and how important it is.
Absolutely. It's funny that you even mentioned the word beauty, because I remember about a year or two ago, I took a photography class through the place I was employed at the time, and they talked about the word beauty in and of itself, and how when you say beauty, it's loaded with associations that are usually cosmetic or fashion related.
And I
don't know off the top of my head what the definition is, but when you essentially cut all that back and just look at the word beauty, it's more related to sort of what the eye catches in the world and what you find happiness and joy in. That's definitely not the Oxford definition, but in essence, that's kind of what it means. So it almost seems like when you take sort of beauty from that perspective, it does translate a little bit more into self-worth and why you would prioritize and see yourself as an item that's worth investing in, perhaps.
I like that idea about investing in yourself.
Yeah.
I think that very often beauty's looked at in this very simplistic, almost, I don't know, patriarchal way that's basically seen as women that are bored and have lots of extra income, and maybe they're narcissistic, so they want to take Pilates all day and get their nails done.
And ladies who lunch,
Ladies who lunch, right? But in that article, they talked about kind of like how the Black Panthers set up like wellness clinics all around the neighborhood to get women to understand that taking care of yourself is actually incredibly important, and it helps to build communities and movements.
Completely. I think even when you look at sort of something like facials or applying moisturizer every day, that could, you know, in the past have been seen as a very sort of feminine oil of Olay cream activity, as, you know, a woman in her nightstand in the powder room. Now it's like a sort of skin cancer preventative measure that's, you know, a must do, the way superfoods are a must eat. And it's more about your body as a temple than than having more time on your hands to file your nails, per se. So, you know, it's funny. It's like the same activities. It's just now we almost have reevaluated the worth and, you know, how to where to spend your time. And beauty's not seen as such a shallow endeavor, so to speak.
So in terms of your own journey in wellness, mm-hmm. when did you become self-aware about your own beauty, wellness, and health routine? Was there a dramatic departure from like a previous lifestyle and you kind of got it together at a certain point, or is it a journey where you're just evolving over time?
Yeah, I think as I became of age, you know, high school, college, that is kind of the period where you find yourself generally mm-hmm. and you learn what habits are nature, what are nurture, meaning sort mm-hmm. of passed on by your familial tendencies. And then you see what else is out there in the world and you kind of have those three to choose from, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
What my intent is based on like biology, what my parents taught me, and then the other options available to me. So I think, you know, until you get time in your life to explore and decide for yourself, mm-hmm. it's hard to really tell what your preferences are
right.
in things, including wellness. And I think it's when you sort of find that rhythm and routine for yourself, at least for me, I needed to be employed and have some sort of regularity in my life in order to figure out where other elements would fit in a consistent way, such as fitness, such mm-hmm. as meal planning, such as meditation. So I think for me, those were things that tended to come together in sort of, I would say my mid-20s is mm-hmm. when I kind of at least felt like I knew myself well enough to stop trying anything and everything out and
right.
sort of start deciding. Mm-hmm. You know what industry we work in because we work together. And so I think there's a part of me that's always interested in trends and what's latest and greatest. So
yeah.
I'll always try a lot of different things out in this space. But I think I wasn't really aware of sort of my choices as part of a broader lifestyle and its effect on my health until sort of mid to late 20s. And I would say in a much more acute way in the past 2 years. I'm thinking since probably like 2014, I started taking
yeah.
a much more active interest. I joined Equinox actually.
And everything changed.
That was when you start actively spending that much money per month
yes.
towards a fitness membership, you
right.
really start to rethink everything.
Right, right. You want to
yeah.
like fortify everything around that investment.
You're
so
like,
you're
okay,
like,
gotta put this to work. Before when you were doing,
yeah.
you know, free yoga to the people classes throughout New York City,
right.
it was a little bit more disposable.
Right, right. That actually is an interesting correlation. And I think so much of fitness motivation, I think you have to have that financial
mm-hmm.
loss associated to get yourself
yeah.
there. It's really hard.
Oh, totally. I mean, and I'm not under any guise. I feel very fortunate that I'm able to afford a membership to Equinox. And I think when I started working in the city, that wasn't something I felt I could afford. And so I was much more used to finding free fitness classes, which are actually, you know, quite readily available
mm-hmm.
in New York City if you have the time and energy to hunt for them and
right.
travel across all boroughs.
Right. Right.
But I think for me, it was sort of a godsend to be able to be at a spot in my life where I could kind of make a decision, invest.
Yeah.
And I think at that time, I knew enough people who were also going to Equinox
okay.
that it became sort of this like community thing. I
right.
felt this, you know, peer connection. It wasn't even that we were going to the gym together, although I think at first when I joined
mm-hmm.
the gym, we
mm-hmm.
did that. But funny enough, it kind of reminded me at this age in my parents' life, they had lived in New York City, and that's when gyms were just sort of first being established.
Okay.
So they used to go to, I can't remember what it was called, but I remember they talk about going to personal training sessions,
that's
and
so
JFK
funny.
Jr. was there. And
it becomes
so,
like their social
yeah,
circle.
So I almost felt like maybe is this my
yeah.
rite of passage
yeah.
in my mid-20s,
yeah.
I join a New York City gym, and
yeah.
it becomes like a social thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's, you know, the success of Barry's Boot Camp and Soul
Completely.
Cycle, people don't want to go out and drink
yeah.
all night. They want to still have endorphins and dance and listen to music, but they rather do that in a fitness setting than
totally.
At a dark club.
And what I can't tell and what is really interesting to me is to see people sort of go through their young 20s in this kind of wellness day and age.
Yes.
Because I do still feel like when I was 21 and 22, working out was it was certainly accepted, and believe me, we had a fitness center in college that everyone used, but it just wasn't like cool in the way it is now. Right. It was more like you, that was a detractor mm-hmm. from potential happy hours you could be attending.
Yes.
And so, so because, and Barry's, what it didn't exist then, or at least not in the way it does now. So I keep wondering if I had been 21 in that environment, I definitely feel like I would have tended towards the sort of healthier end of things, but I'll and never know.
I should say that you're speaking as if you're like, you know, in your late 60s, like back in my day, you know,
30s.
This is like a shift that's happened in the past like 3 to 4 years.
Really?
It's like a very kind of recent shift. Is there anything that you look back on from high school, early 20s that you did that you just think like, why did I even bother? Why did I do that?
All the time. I mean, I don't think for me it was wasted money on beauty ventures or fitness activities per se. I think it was more that I didn't prioritize sleep. I would say that was the main thing. You know, Arianna Huffington and her sleep revolution. Just in general, I think I didn't recognize that having that solid chunk of sleep is sort of a core foundation to being a functioning and happy member of society.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think growing up, I always sort of tended towards falling asleep later at night because those night, I was involved in a lot of different activities growing up because I was just, I am a curious person.
Yeah.
I want to try out a lot of things. So those night hours when everyone else is asleep were my time to be creative, get things done.
Right.
Unfortunately, that time I also discovered later in my life was time I needed to be in bed.
Yes. And recharging.
Exactly.
And yeah.
So I think perhaps I wish I had discovered that earlier just because it does help you sort of handle the bumps and curves that life throws at you much better if you're doing it on 8 hours or
well,
7 hours.
Well, being well rested makes a huge difference in my mood. And it's something that I've had to explain to Umut, my husband. Like, if I don't get to bed at a certain time, I'm going to be in a horrible mood for no reason. Like, I'm just going to be in a, I'm just going to wake up in a bad mood and stay in a bad mood. And I think it's interesting. I think it's with the new iOS update, you can now set an alarm for bedtime as well as when you wake up. And it's so much harder than you, you think like, oh, how hard is it to force myself to go to bed an hour earlier? But it's really hard. I'm like struggling with
it. It's a loss. I mean, I think, in any sort of activity, especially now with sort of, self-care taking off, that means that you have to reprioritize. So activities that may well be enjoyable and pleasurable to you might have to get, you know, pushed down on the totem pole. So, you know, we work in TV. I love TV. I love watching TV. It may mean that I watch a little less TV.
Right.
There's also less time between when one day ends and the next feels like it begins. So it's almost like, I remember when I first started kind of exploring the topic, we described it, it's a sense of loss, right?
Yeah.
And any time you prioritize an activity over the other, you're essentially losing one. Mm-hmm. And that hurts a little bit.
Do you think some of it has to do with like deep-seated childhood memories of your parents telling you, go to bed, and kind of as a young person, you want to rebel and stay up late past your bedtime? Does some of it feel like maybe we're like still rebelling against that?
I think that certainly must be part of it for a lot of people. I'm a child of graphic designers, and so I kind of remember this spirit of them up late working on art projects.
Cool.
So I think that's actually what kind of instilled in me this late night tendency.
Got it.
Because for a specific example, my parents used to make us Halloween costumes, these over-the-top Halloween
costumes. I've seen the pictures on your Instagram.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And so what I remember is I remember doing brainstorming sessions months out, but then like the real work happened the night before at 12 to 3 a.m.
Your parents invited, was it you and your brother? They invited you guys to brainstorming.
Family brainstorming, like drawing tissue sessions.
That's
it was
so
like
cool.
An agency before I even knew what agencies processes were. I know. I don't think we were that self-aware to realize that. It was just kind of fun at the time. And so But yeah, I remember that the sort of like critical parts of those projects happening in the middle of the night, hearing my parents, you know, cursing themselves as they're burning their fingers on that, you know, hot glue gun. And so I think that's when I kind of got this sense, and it stuck with me throughout middle school, high school, and college, that, you know, you could pull an all-nighter, right? And in college then, that's when I kind of just really doubled down on how far you can stretch the all-nighter. So I remember in college doing like two nights in a row. Which
Are you like hallucinating at that point?
You're delusional. Yeah. You should not drive. You should not do anything. It's completely ridiculous. And I think then maybe I'm rebelling against that. So so I used to be a big procrastinator, right? I would pull all-nighters. Now I'm like the opposite of that. Right. I like getting stuff done. So I think I'm truly haunted by the memory of staying up all night and just how terrible your body feels after that. You really feel terrible. You crash.
Of course, yeah.
And so I think after doing that in a world where you sort of have hours that are mandated by a force other than yourself,
right,
I said, okay, got to make some changes. And that was kind of the start.
Yeah, it's really interesting that work helped you to be more regimented, because I think a lot of people feel the opposite. Like they kind of have their act together and then they start working and they kind of lose sight. But I'm kind of like you. Like I think having work and the work schedule helps you to kind of maintain everything around it.
It does. I mean, if you lived in a world where you had truly a 9-to-5 job, I imagine you could have a great degree of routine and regularity in your life. I think one of the things that probably draws people with our personality to our job is that you have a little routine and that you vaguely know what part of town you're going to every day.
Right.
And you know what industry you're working in.
Right.
But aside from there, each day could dramatically vary and change that morning. And so I think we have just enough to keep it kind of crazy. But,
to keep us on our toes.
Keep us on our toes.
Of my approach to wellness and health is testing and adjusting. I always tell myself this, like, just test and then adjust, and then adjust. And it's allowed me to figure out what works for me and what doesn't work. And as you said, you don't know what works until you test something and it fails horribly. Are there things that you're kind of actively testing, or have you kind of perfected your formula?
I think if I said I perfected anything, I would be a delusional human being. I just think it's really, really hard to...
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, well, probably also because... As of late, I've been focusing a lot on sort of the more, the aspects of Buddhism that are a little more secular and blend, lend themselves well to sort of mindfulness and self-soothing. One of the main tenets and principles of that is when you sit down to sort of meditate or have a mindful moment, begin again. So you're always, that's kind of that, it's a phrase that comes up a lot. So you're always beginning again, because in any moment when you meditate, your attention is fleeting, right? In Buddhism, one of the only things that is known to be true is that everything is always changing.
Right.
So I think that aligns perfectly with your approach of sort of testing and moving as you go, because I think we know for sure that most of these things, even if we have some routine in our life, the world is changing rapidly.
Yeah.
We work in an industry that's changing rapidly, and we know that based on human nature, we're changing rapidly. So I think you have to be pretty fluid in your approach. I think you can have some sort of default indicators, like I try to stick to this type of food or go to bed at this time-ish. But there's a lot of ish in my life.
I think you have to be flexible, otherwise you drive yourself crazy.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a recipe for defeat. I mean, if you look at sort of happiness, right? Such a debated concept, what makes people happy. I think we know that what makes people not happy is having an expectation, right, in your head and then not meeting it. So if you approach life with a degree of rigidity, that's just a recipe for that.
Yep. And I think this is a perfect segue into the discussion about New Year's resolutions.
Oh, because
it's December now, and every December, you know, you see these trend pieces, people talk about it, what are your New Year's resolutions going to be? I found a quote from Oprah. The quote is, cheers to a new year and another chance for us to get it right. The reason why that stood out to me, it's to your thing about begin again, right? People see the year as this kind of like definitive bookmark, and everything that I didn't get right this year, I have next year to get it right. The reason why 80% of New Year's resolutions fail is because people make really lofty goals that are unrealistic. And then, as you just mentioned, that failure, even if it's mid-January when you start to fail, it just becomes like you just feel defeated and you're like, I've given up. Do you believe in New Year's resolutions?
I think if I believe in resolutions, period, or self-improvement, then sure, I believe they can happen at New Year's. I also think they can happen in February. Restricting yourself to New Year's as a period to make change is just unnecessarily tough on, I mean, I think self-improvement has to be approached with a good degree of gentleness and understanding that there's so many variables that can cause one to deter from the projected path. So by restricting a time around which, you know, improvement can be made, that's just one way to possibly feel defeated when no defeat should be felt.
I love what you said about gentleness, because it reminds me of, this was maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when I was thinking about New Year's resolutions. I just moved to London and I was thinking, okay, I'm gonna do all these things. And I read this advice about how the best resolutions are adding something to your life rather than taking away. So rather than saying, I will not eat carbs and junk food ever, you make a resolution to eat 2 to 3 servings of fresh vegetables every single day. And that feels a lot more enriching and fun and fulfilling. Like to challenge yourself to do more of something good is a lot gentler than forcing yourself to, like, you know, get rid of a horrible habit or never do something.
And I think the truth is, it's really hard to sort of make sweeping statements on how change is made for specific individuals, because we're all motivated by different factors. And even I, you know, have, and I like to think I'm somewhat self-aware in this space, I've looked at times when I've successfully versus non-successfully made changes, and it's still somewhat of a mystery to me.
There's no,
you know,
like, clear pattern.
I read about this so much. I read so many different wonderful blogs and books on human beings and how we decide and how we make changes and the power of habit. And and even that, and even looking at a scope of like a 10-year period in my life when I made major changes, or when I successfully, like, you know, started exercising or did things, it tends to be pretty situation and context specific and contextual. So like Equinox, that was, I happened to have a lot of friends who were going to Equinox. It was like the right offer at the right time. And location wise, it was close to work. It wasn't like, it wasn't anything that I could have specifically plucked out of one article. It just happened to be a combination of factors in my life that led to it. So I think it's tough, because you can really drive yourself crazy at, you know, thinking this is what will cause me to make a change. Instead, I just know some general tendencies that I associate with habit formation for me. And I recognize that at any given time, there's a whole bunch of other variables that are going to cause it to be kind of a crapshoot. But you keep trying.
And I think it's so interesting how we all kind of study ourselves now. Like, I think about how much data I have on myself. Like, I've got my steps every day. I enter my, like, food on my Fitness Pal. I can see how many grams of carbs I ate. I can see how much I slept. Like, we have all this data on ourselves. I don't really know. I guess I'm just doing it out of habit, because I feel like it's that whole thing, like, you can't manage what you can't measure. So I'm like, okay, let me just keep measuring these things. But what is it all really?
I think it's helpful to the extent that we find it helpful.
That's true.
If I was on a program where I was being managed by like medical professionals, then, oh, that's so wonderful that now Apple has a health app that kind of like integrates all of our other apps and they could sort of log in through here. I just upgraded my phone yesterday and I was looking through and I actually had, for the amount of interest in health, I had a shockingly low awareness of all the bells and whistles available to me.
Yeah.
And I turned it on and I remember essentially thinking about what you were just talking about. Oh my gosh, there's so much more I could be doing.
Right.
I have gone through periods where I've tracked stuff more. Right now I'm not, just because I have enough on my plate.
Right.
I don't need to track more. I don't want another assignment at the end of the day. But that's because I'm sort of kind of following, I'm in a place where I can kind of follow my gut on choices. But at times when I've sort of at least felt like I've fallen off the track more, or, you know, maybe felt like I hadn't been eating as healthy, then it's great to know the tools are available.
Yeah.
Just, it's almost like all not driving yourself crazy with.
So how long have you been meditating?
Well, meditation, I think, I've always been really interested in psychology, right? And so one of my majors in college was psychology. And I think even in my role in the workplace, I am doing psychology just as it relates to brands and consumers.
Yep.
So at one point when I was thinking of becoming a therapist, I got really interested in types of therapy. And there's and this is where, like, if any scholar were to listen to this podcast, like, you can't take my word as truth because I have not studied up on this in many years. But there's different types of therapy. And one was by a woman named Marsha Linehan, who was, I believe she had, borderline personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And she developed kind of a derivative of CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is more about changing the way you think, and developed this therapy called DBT, which is, I think it stands for like dialectic behavioral therapy.
Okay.
And basically her therapeutic approach took a lot of the elements of Zen Buddhism, right? Yeah. And incorporated it into how to sort of approach difficult situations. It was a lot of self-soothing, different theories in it were things like radical acceptance, which is like very, you know, AA, like accept the things I cannot change, power to know the difference. That, things like wise mind, which is the sort of central place where rational mind and emotional mind overlap.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people call it intuition or gut. Understanding introversion and extroversion. So her techniques, I think, when I remember studying that, sort of seeing that and seeing those sort of more secular aspects of Buddhism, and meditation was a component of that. Over the years, as I sort of followed that, you've seen this kind of evolve into like mindfulness therapy and different sort of approaches to meditation that are much more. So I guess to answer your question in a more concise way, my interest in psychology always sort of got me thinking about it, because I've always been interested in the brain, what happens when it goes off the rails and how people get it back on track. But then as it sort of became a bit more of a, once wellness kind of became a sort of cool thing where it was, you know, pervading other parts of our culture, it almost like put it much more front and center on my radar, because I was getting at it in all aspects of my life, not just my sort of like side interest in psychology. So, you know, when I join Equinox and then meditations offered at Equinox, then it sort of starts to come back. So
what's that like at Equinox? You just sit in one of the fitness rooms with the lights off and someone talks?
Equinox is, now I don't want to turn this into an ad for Equinox, but
this is not a promoted ad for Equinox.
Their yoga offering is wonderful in that it's most of the studios are designed so they have a separate sort of yoga area versus fitness areas. The mindfulness area does feel very zen, with the right props and tools to get you there. I'm just continuously overwhelmed in New York City by the amount of meditation and mindfulness that's available to us.
Know.
I mean, there's been, with any sort of resurgence of a trend, there's another wave of backlash that comes in. So I think some people who probably were into mindfulness way ahead of the curve might, you know, on one hand be so happy that it's getting much more exposure, yeah. and another hand feel a little bit sad that it's become a little commercialized yeah. and diluted and maybe even cost prohibitive for mm-hmm. some people. Mm-hmm. That's something that is certainly very anti-Buddhist in its
right.
nature. Like right. you shouldn't have to be able to pay afford money to meditate. Yeah. But I think overall, I'm just thrilled with the fact that the offering is cropped up in yeah. such a diversified way, you know.
What are the biggest benefits for you?
Sure.
Like, what have you seen change since you've started meditating?
Yeah, I think, I think one thing I'll mention about meditating is it doesn't really get easier. I think you can, that's the whole begin again thing. So there's some days where I feel like it's really difficult, some days where I feel like it's easier, some days where I just can't stay awake when I'm meditating. And I also don't meditate for incredibly long periods of time. Sort of like fitness, I need to be in a room with people if I want to do something like for a longer period. If I'm doing it on my own, you're talking about like a 5 to 10 minute, like super approachable time period. Since I started, I think I'm just much more appreciative about pausing and the power of pausing in general, and sort of the cult of busyness, how that's actually something that's not appealing or attractive to me anymore. I think it translates a lot into different aspects of our life. Mindfulness in eating, sort of like yep. the ability to eat more slowly, that's one I'm always still working on. You always shovel food like it's going out of style. But I think, you know, in a corporate environment, pausing before reacting, mm-hmm. writing emails, that's been really helpful. Mm. I remember meditating and then noticing an upswing in my ability to like think before responding to things yeah. in a bigger way.
Which aligns with Don Draper's amazing yeah. Mad Men finale where he was meditating yes. and got the idea for the Coke commercial.
Yes, yeah.
I could yeah. see it helping with kind of creative thinking.
It certainly helps with creative thinking. And I think overall it's also just the act of doing it sort of puts a stamp on the fact that it's a priority in your life. Mm-hmm. I've also noticed that I talk about it a lot more. I've surrounded myself with people who are interested in it. I've also noticed since I've become interested in it that like way more people than I ever thought might be interested in it are interested in it.
You should do like a team meditation thing. That would be so fun.
I mean, and what's interesting is it does really seem to touch all aspects of my life. Like I'm on a school board for the high school I went to. Since joining the board, I've been interested in the fact that they now have a wellness director at school, and they're wow. using you know, wellness and mindfulness techniques at an early age in a very sort of small and applied way as to not distract from the school curriculum. But there's really like nothing that wouldn't benefit from a little bit of mindfulness. Yeah. I think the important thing is just to kind of make sure that it's not put too much on a pedestal, right? Like yes. mindfulness doesn't equal happiness. It just right. equals like self-awareness and, right. you know, so being in the moment means experiencing all emotions.
Right.
I think it's just like, it's a way to find a little bit more balance, which is a really hard thing to find.
Yeah, especially in this city.
It's not a cure-all by any means, but it's almost just like a continual reminder that your life is worth valuing and your mm-hmm. self,
yeah.
I guess. I don't know. You seem very peaceful. I would expect you to be a meditator. If you're yeah. not, you must be channeling it somehow.
I used to meditate, and I stopped because I didn't know if it was really doing anything. And that goes back to, I think it's a problem with always wanting to quantify results and say, yeah. okay, so this is the time I put in, what's the benefit of it? And you can't have that approach, I think, for meditation. But I think that I've tried to employ like mindfulness in other things. So
yes.
I cook maybe pretty much every night after work. I'll come home and I cook.
That's incredibly impressive.
And I use that as, I really think it's like mindfulness cooking. Like I don't yeah. let anyone talk to me. Like I'm just chopping the vegetables slowly and simmering and listening. Like it's very, for me, it's, and also like when I exercise, I take that as like yeah. time to connect with my body. So I try to make those opportunities to connect.
To me, that's doing it. I'm really not a purist. And I remember for many days thinking, you know, before I started, I was testing. I was trying and adjusting, and adjusting. And so I remember having a hard time fitting it in and doing a 20-minute meditation. I just thought, wow, that feels really prohibitive. And so I would do things like on my walk to work, try to just be mindful for 10 minutes, just observe the sights and sounds. And there is nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier, being gentle to yourself and sort of just not being too hard on, you know, if you define mindfulness as something that has to happen, like sitting in a certain position on a certain, you know, time of day, maybe that works great for some people. For me, it doesn't. And I would guess for a lot of people who are just trying it out, that would be a recipe for feeling like...
So I'm really excited to ask you about this because I know you observe a lot of trends and it's in your work and then also you're personally interested in it. In the beauty and wellness space, what are the trends that you're really excited about? Or is there a single trend that you think is really interesting?
Sure. So, I mean, we've talked a lot about mindfulness and meditation, so that's certainly one that's of interest to me. I think in general, one thing that I've gotten a lot more into lately is sort of the quality. I read this book called The New Health Rules by Frank Lipman.
He is,
what I loved about it was the book was like really large font and very short. There was like one line
like
a page, just like, try to eat more vegetables.
Yeah.
Like, try to do X. And I loved that it was not overly detailed in what you should or shouldn't do. It was very principle-based. It did tell you a few things, though, that could be major life changes for some people, like try to not eat dairy because our bodies mostly don't process lactose the way that we would like them to.
Yes.
Really tough for me because I ate a lot of dairy. What I'm trying to do is eat less and eat better quality dairy, right? He focuses on eating non-gluten grains, right? Without even going into the whole gluten-free, you know, fad, because I'm not that far. So I'm trying to make changes based on that. And so far, what I actually like about it is that in this crazy city where there's a billion options of healthy things to eat, it gives me a little guardrail.
Yeah.
So when I look at a menu, I can say, does that fall into Frank Lipman's Be Well structure?
Check it out.
It was almost like, I think for a while there was so many wonderful healthy food options and we're so privileged to have that, but I kind of needed a little less choice. So I was into this book and his sort of philosophy and that it makes our choices a little bit easier.
Yeah.
It's definitely not a diet. It's just a sort of articulation of principles. There's nothing I write down, nothing that I'm referencing. It's just things I think of in my head. So I've been into that lately, for sure. I think one other thing is that I'm just so into the fact that talking about beauty and wellness is like awesome and a lot of people are interested in it now. You know, that was something that just so surprised me over the years. I feel like most of my friend gatherings now I look at times when I get together as friends, I'm like, is that a women's wellness circle? I'm just excited by how like common these themes have become. That's really wonderful. I hopefully it bodes well for, I mean, there's so many parts of America where hunger is actually food insecurity, right? Where people just don't have access to information about nutrition or nutritious food. So I'm hoping that if we're seeing this sort of pop up in cities like New York and LA, that we can start helping, you know, the trend make its way to the parts of America that really need it.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
Yeah.
Any trends that you really don't like or that you want to see disappear?
Sure. So, I mean, I can't say I really hate anything because when we talked about this before, I think, especially with changes in fitness and eating, which are such personal things, you have to, I think it's really good to maintain a wide spectrum of trends because, you know, every pot's got their lid, right?
Right,
and
right.
So, but I think ones that are generally too negative in their reinforcement, I think that's one I'd like to see eventually phased out. I mean,
what would
boot
be?
Camps where trainers yell at people. It's tough because I think, you know, that can be effective per se. And I remember seeing that there was an app at one point where you had to pay for not going to the gym.
Oh,
and
yeah, I've
I
heard
remember
about
thinking
these.
That's really effective. But I don't know. I guess for some people it works. But
yeah.
For me, I found that a little bit like, is that really the best way to think about this?
It's not that gentle or kind to yourself.
Yeah. I mean, in one aspect, I know for a lot of people that the gym is a way to get aggression out. And they don't want to get wrapped in a blanket. They don't want to be part of a wellness circle. They just want to, you know, vent and get their frustration out. So I don't want to take that edge off for anyone else. And I love, you know, like slamming it down in a good workout session just as much as the next person. So I can't say I hate anything that much. I mean, restrictive dieting.
You're very kind.
Yeah. I don't know. Over the years, you just sort of learn to not be that way.
Not judge other.
Yeah. And putting it in perspective.
Yeah.
I think restrictive dieting is pretty tough. And that's one thing that I think is generally less trendy, but, it's tough because it's not really sustainable.
Right, like counting calories.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I think, I don't think it's a problem for people to roughly know what is in the foods that they eat. Like, mm-hmm. there's no issue in knowing how many calories is in an orange or whether it's a high sugar fruit.
Right.
It's just like balancing that so you're not overly obsessed. It's being realistic. Trends that aren't realistic.
Yes.
For a lifestyle, that's what I would like to see fade away.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah, what about you? What do you hate?
Oh gosh, there's so many things.
Like, how do I choose?
I'm like not as kind as you. Yeah. I think, have you heard about waist trainers?
Oh my gosh, I saw that. I saw that in the Dwayne Reed the other day.
Honestly, frightening.
Yeah.
Speaking of Dwayne Reed, and I think that one of the things that I find to be a troubling trend are everyday women doing their hair and makeup as if they're like on a red carpet.
Wow.
Like when, and Amy Schumer has a great joke about this, about how women have to do so much just to look normal and like men basically have to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there, and you can blame the Kardashians, you can blame all of these YouTube tutorials, but I do see that women are becoming increasingly made up and like glamorous.
Yeah.
And they feel like they have to have fake nails, fake hair, eyelash extensions, contouring.
Right, like when did that become a thing? Eyelash extensions.
Right, like everyone is has become so preoccupied with like being glamazons in a way that, and I always think about American beauty versus the way Italians approach beauty or the French. And I think one of the things that for me really defines American beauty is this natural, like it's the healthy looking natural girl. And I feel like we're moving away from that and no one really wants to look natural anymore.
I mean, it's such an interesting point that you bring up. And I guess now that I'm thinking about it, I think with the sort of the freely disseminated information that is spread thanks to technology in the digital age, I think things that were normally relegated to movie stars, right? Tricks of the trade, that previously would have been the Kardashians and only the Kardashians and their stylists are now made available and en masse. That's why I can walk into a place and have the knowledge and wherewithal to ask for eyelash extensions before I probably wouldn't even like realize that's a thing that celebrities
thing that
are doing. I'd just be like, why are their eyelashes so long and mine are so short? And so I think that the options, the proliferation of options available to us is certainly overwhelming. And I think unless you have a really good filter, it's easy to get kind of sucked into that maze. I think one of the things I've always viewed sort of makeup, there was a, time in my life where I actually did want to be a makeup artist.
Really? You're very good at makeup. Younger, I always notice your makeup's very pretty and interesting.
I think the approach is I love doing it with my fingers, and I look at it like it's like art and fun, and you're playing.
Yeah, you do nice expressive.
And I love also not wearing makeup, because makeup is time and it's work.
Yeah.
And some days I don't feel like doing that. So I, you know, I think I will dress super down some days and then up if I feel like it.
Right.
I agree with you that maybe I could not be in an environment where there was an underlying pressure to go glamazon every day. Some people thrive in that. I think for most people, you know, it's probably a tougher standard, but thanks to fast fashion and other resources, you can dress like a movie star every day if you wanted to, probably for $20.
Right.
I just don't have the interest in in exploring that.
I think you bring up a great point about, one, feeling like you have the option.
Yeah.
And two, makeup being fun. Yeah. I also love makeup, and sometimes it's fun to put on, you know, red lip, and sometimes it's fun to do something new with your hair. But one of the things that I worry about, especially for like younger girls growing up now, is when it doesn't feel like an option, when it feels like a must.
Yeah.
And they're not doing it to play with their pretty features. Like, oh, the color of my eyes looks great with this eyeliner. And it becomes, how do I correct? How do I cover up and conceal and change the shape of my face?
I know. Well, thank goodness for Alicia Keys and her natural look. Now, every time I'm not wearing makeup, it's now like a statement, which I love.
Yes.
I love that. No,
Thank you, Alicia, for making us feel better.
I mean, I think that when you look at there was actually a video. I don't remember who put it out. I think it may have been BuzzFeed. And I love BuzzFeed's videos, but this video was, the topic was so funny to me. It was boyfriends see their girlfriends without makeup for the first time. Did you see that?
I rolled.
And I kept thinking, for the first time? Like, for the first time? How is that possible to date someone and have them not know what you look like without makeup? Of course, the reactions were all very gracious and complimentary, as they should be, but... but yeah, it's definitely something that I think we want to make sure that people realize that these are add-on bells and whistles to have fun with and make you feel good about yourself. So yeah, I think it has to sort of be like put into its place in general. But the things you can do with makeup are amazing.
Yes, they are. And so fun, and it's an opportunity
thankfully
to express
for
yourself.
Makeup artists, like, I mean, I remember poring over those books by Bobby Brown, who was a big proponent of like natural beauty, makeup that enhances your features. Kevin Aucoin, he was very
I have his book.
It's a Making Faces.
Making Faces.
Amazing.
It's amazing.
Like he could make, you know, person A look like person B. And to me, I was thought, wow, that can show you makeup is sort of this like transformative art. It's fun and you can channel it when you want. But as a mandate, no, I don't think it should exist like that.
This is my last question.
Sure.
I ask all of my guests.
Yes.
When do you feel most beautiful?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. Because I think it happens, at least for me, in glimpses when I'm usually not expecting it. But I think for me, it's funny. Okay, so I'm going to describe this like esoteric segment of time. It's if I get ready for an event, so when the makeup's fresh, for example, that's like, it's like just on your face. And you're like, okay, wow, someone applied a layer of something that's like alien. It's usually like after a few hours, right? When like... you know, I've had fun. I might have applied a little glitter because I love glitter. I always have. But then you're starting to see sort of my natural face a little bit. And I'm making it sound like I wear like gobs of makeup.
No,
I really don't.
I 100% know what you mean. And a lot of people who get their makeup professionally done, they'll say to shower after so that like, the like it kind of settles on your face.
Exactly.
So I know what you mean.
And it's sort of like when So it's not fresh, and you start to come through a little bit. It's like kind of that twilight, that sweet spot.
I know exactly
like,
what you mean.
You've enhanced your features, but it's really settled in and you're coming out. I mean, if I was to tell you, like, I feel the most beautiful right after I work out, I'd be lying. I might feel physically great, but like, no. So I think if I'm being totally honest from a sort of vanity perspective, that's probably when I feel the best.
A few hours into the makeup being done. I like that.
Yeah.
I can relate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think the second time period, I would say, is like at the end of the night when you come home and you like basically like, you know, at the end of the night, your jewelry just all of a sudden feels super heavy.
Yeah, you just want to rip everything
all
off.
All of a sudden, all of a sudden, each of your necklace feels like it's 1,000 pounds.
Exactly.
You're like, how have I been wearing this albatross all day?
Exactly.
So I think when you take that off, then sometimes you look at the mirror at the end of the night. I think maybe, at least for a woman, that for me is something where I remember seeing my mom at that point and noticing how beautiful she looked.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of the glimpse in which I'm like, wow, we're lucky to be women and get to play dress up.
Yeah, we are. That's a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much for
coming. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful.